to season 5 of The Access Point, where we examine real challenges Black and brown professionals face at work and offer expert advice on dealing with your organization, your boss, your coworkers, and your career. I am Dr. Wendy M. Edmonds. I'm an author, management consultant, and interim chair of the Management, Marketing, and Public Administration Department in Higher Ed. My area of research is toxic followership. That's right. Why do people follow bad people? And I am a workplace toxicologist helping you to dismantle the poison people bring to work. Now, I am not alone. I have a wonderful co-host, Dr. Lonnie Morris. Dr. Lonnie, take it away.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wendy. It is always exciting to be here with you. I'm excited for this season. I'm glad this is the first episode of season 5 for us. I am Lonnie Morris. I'm a management consultant and professor. My area of expertise is org development and org behavior. I spend most of my time helping really smart people unravel complicated organizations. And so I love that we get to have these talks to help you do that and to get us there today. We have an incredible guest, and I'm so excited to have Dr. Markeisha Webster with us. She is the Director of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging. That's an important piece. At the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. That's important to me because I'm from California. She came to the agency after 2.5 years as a director of the Office of Equity and Human Rights for the City of Portland and special advisor to the mayor. This is big. And she previously served as the director of the Office of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the Oregon Department of Education. And she came out of that from being, she told me, an educator, a high school teacher, a college professor. And her work is specifically focused on anti-racism, equity, diversity, inclusion, culturally responsive practice, intersectionality, eradicating anti-Black racism, and working to eliminate systems of oppression. I think I came to the right place today. Dr. Markeisha, welcome to the Access Point.
Thank you so very much for having me. And when you read that, I was like, oh, that's all, like, those are things that I've done and things that I aspire to do, right? So that's super exciting. When I hear it right now, I'm energized. I was like, I got a lot of work to do. So thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, that we all have a lot of work to do. And that's why we have these conversations. And we are so excited to have you to help us kick off doing this work in another season. So I think as we...
Before we get started,
Dr. Wendy, go ahead, Dr.
yes,
Wendy.
We're going to let you know what our disclaimer is. The thoughts and views expressed in tonight's discussion do not reflect the views of any organization with which the hosts or guests may be affiliated with. Now, let's kick it off.
Well, let me say something here, because you see, I tried to skip over that because we're talking about anti-Black racism and all this racial justice. Like, I don't care what y'all think today. But Dr. Wendy always keeps me in check, so I'm glad we got back to that. I appreciate you. This is why you're here, because, you know, I go off, right? I got excited about Dr. Markeisha. So let's go. All right. So now we have the proper disclaimer in place, so y'all don't be sending me no crazy DMs and mad messages. But so let's start with something I think is really, really important to level set for us. Since we're talking about this spectrum of anti-Black racism, and we're really trying to bring us up to speed from all the things we missed in the summer, and we're specifically today going to talk about these things around decisions and affirmative action. But I think, Dr. Markeisha, what will help us level set for everyone is if we talk about, help define, what is affirmative action and why should people care about it? Can you start us off there?
Yeah, that's a really good question, right? And I think really as we think about sort of the historical context of affirmative action, really providing, particularly in our higher education spaces, opportunities for, I'll say folks of color, right? We'll start it there. But providing opportunities for students, for young folks to really have access to education, right, to higher education, and to be able to use that, right, to pursue whatever goals. And what we do know, and it's no surprise, like there's no system broken, right? Education isn't broken. It functions the way that it was intended to function. And as such, It has not functioned in favor of access and opportunity for Black folks, right? Black and brown folks. And so affirmative action really being some court decisions, right? Just sort of taking the law and applying it to a problem, right? Trying to fix this problem. And now, of course, as we know, we've entered into a new phase of what this looks like. And I know there's a lot of controversy around this decision. Has been a lot of controversy really about affirmative action, right? And a lot of folks have viewed it as reverse racism, right? A lot of really interesting conversations over the years. I think California is in a unique place, and we'll sort of get to that in a moment, where some of the affirmative action components don't affect California in the same way because of some additional law. But really, when I think about affirmative action, I think about access and opportunity, and in particular, in education spaces. But we could also talk about what that means in the workplace as well. So I'll leave it there. I won't get too textbooky, but...
Textbooky is fine. We're here to educate. So, but I want to springboard off of that, because I think sort of just thinking of what this means for access and opportunities for people, because just was this last week, maybe the week or so ago, and inside higher ed, I saw this that Yale University reached an agreement in an affirmative action case. So this stemmed from a group of students who were already saying, hey, we're pushing back on using race as part of decision-making for college admissions. And then we saw the Supreme Court decision over the summer saying, you don't get to do that anymore. And what Yale's agreement with this group of students and alumni who were pushing back on this was saying that they're going to update the training around this so that people who are making admissions decisions or involved in those decisions are explicit about not using race. They're removing access to race data for anyone involved in the admissions process. So you can't even see the race around who's applying anymore. You won't be able to see that. They're canceling any reports related to aggregate race data and ethnicity in the data. So if they start to combing through this and looking at where we are in the process, race will not be part of how they consider it and have those conversations. And they are removing race from financial aid packaging considerations, right? So we know when it starts to happen at schools like Yale, part of it is because people have to do it because the law is changing, then we see it permeate throughout the system. My question to you, Dr. Markeisha and Dr. Wendy, is why do decisions like this around college admissions, why is that important to us at work?
And I don't know if you want me to kick it off. I will.
You are our guest. Absolutely.
So the first thing top of mind for me is we think about a pipeline, and we think about where we get the employers that we find in our workspace. And as we talk about how we are wanting to diversify our workspaces, I hear that a lot, right, from the folks in our talent acquisition team. We're trying to diversify our workforce. We want the workforce to be reflective of the community that we serve. And we think about the impact of decisions like the reversing of affirmative action, what that means, again, for access and opportunity. So if I am not sort of in a space where I have access and opportunity to education, then that doesn't necessarily put me in the pipeline, right? In what we would say a more traditional way. Doesn't mean it won't happen, right? But as we think about folks who, you know, get a college degree, right, and enter the workforce, doesn't look like that for some folks. And I think, you know, our efforts in terms of how we are trying to expand what our workforce looks like are heavily impacted by that. So we don't think about it sort of in that context, but as we're trying to build a pipeline, this has significant impacts on that, you know, just that recruitment, right? And what that looks like for folks who are stepping into the workplace, you know, taking their first job, right? Whatever that may be, that those opportunities become more limited.
Yeah, I also think you know, we're moving towards removing race related information, but what about the testing? I mean, that's the other part that's not really being talked about. It's like, look at us over here. We're doing all these wonderful things. But some pieces still exist that can contribute to exclusion. And so I often think about when is that going to show up, that addressing that we need to consider that. And as far as the workspace, they said that they don't like using the term blind resumes or blind CVs because that's an ableist term. But what it means is that all the identifiers are removed. And so if the identifiers are removed, it eliminates, or I would say minimizes, biases when people apply for jobs. So I think about that as well, that needs to take place more often than we think. So when there is a name that someone may consider to be a Black name, right?
And there are a bunch of them.
Maybe we should just use initials.
Let's be clear.
I'm like,
because what we haven't said is Dr. Lonnie used to be director of admissions. I was a VP for enrollment. So I've seen all of that. And I've had some time to look at names and go, this my people right here. I know because the name on this application say Jodeci. I know who this is. You don't gotta tell me nothing else. I don't need to see no race check.
It can be some white people named Jodeci. You don't know. It could be white people named Jodeci.
Right.
Or you don't know. Or Portia. You don't know that.
Oh my God. I'm sorry, Dr. Wendy, finish.
It does. I was done. I'm really just thinking, when are we going to have that conversation as part of this, right?
Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really important, right? So part of this is saying there's some legal stuff we have to adhere to, but there's some reality checks that we also need to be aware of, that the checking the box about race and ethnicity isn't the only indicator this person comes from a particular community. Looking at the financials of a family that's applying to college isn't the only indicator. There are other ways. And so what I hope we're seeing as we connect these decisions around college admissions to what we're going to see in the workplace. And thank you, Dr. Markeisha, for saying this is a pipeline issue, that we are also beginning to be extremely proactive about stripping these processes from all of those barriers and indicators that will keep us from prevailing, because we know those things exist. And in some cases, it might just be your name, right? It doesn't have to be that you've checked the box to say, I am these other things. It could just be the name or the perception of this name comes from this type of community. So that's going to be really important, because if we're stopping people from getting into schools where they can get access to the types of careers that will change their families and change their communities, then we've got a much larger problem than just the ethnicity and race boxes on admissions applications.
And we also have to consider how important the name issue is. So, we look at how some names are given. So I was recently at a research conference, and there were a number of people from different countries, different places in Africa, and they were saying how naming the child is so important. Right, we're talking about lineage. The names are identifiable from where you're from, where the part of Africa you are, and that was so interesting to me. And so, what seems to be so admirable in your village, in your country, when you are here, that very same thing you are happy and proud of is the very same thing that can keep you and prevent you from being successful in the USA, in our country, home of the land and the free, right?
So I'm thinking, where is my name from? I don't, I get nothing. If you pull up Lonnie Morris' application, you're like, oh, just let him go through.
I can speak from personal experience having a name, Markeisha, that has just enough.
Put her in the black pile.
Right? We know where she's from. But a lot of people don't know, like, I'm actually named after both of my grandmothers. Like, a part of, right, the letters in my name are after both of my grandmothers. But, like, just, you don't know. I mean, the Keisha, maybe not so much, right? That's sort of a 70s thing. But certainly there was the Mar for Martha, my middle, like there. So there's a story behind that. But I have been told and even advised that I want to go by an alias because there were, you know, I had some time ago, but mentors that felt like at some point my name would be a hindrance to me advancing in my career, sort of, you know, reaching whatever aspirations I had. And I was like, that's a very interesting perspective. I had not thought about that. Not going to do it, right? But just that one, and this was a Black mentor, right? Like, so just even that, you know, that level of advice giving for a young professional was very, at that moment, profound for me to think about the significance of that, right? So.
And consider the place at which that advice came to you. That was a pain point. That was an experience.
Absolutely.
No, don't let this happen to you.
Absolutely.
And what I think about that, right, is those that type of advice comes from a place of wanting to protect us, wanting to shepherd us into good spaces, wanting to make sure we make it to what you mentioned, Dr. Markeisha, we get into the pipeline.
That's true.
So that is someone saying, an elder saying, I know what's out here. I'm giving you this nugget because I know it can help you. You can do with it what you want, but I've seen what's on this side here. I know how they act. I know what they say. I know how they separate. I know how they put up walls. So if you do this, doesn't mean those other things might not happen to you, but this will be one thing you don't have to worry about, right? So that is, and we talk about this a lot in the Access Point, that's trauma informed. That is trauma informed. So things that like this, and we started from just the core of the affirmative action decision from the Supreme Court and how we get, this gets us to the pipeline of the workforce. But these things are our people saying, let me protect you and safeguard the space for you so you don't have to fill in the blank. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, not just not to take us down a little rabbit hole, but it also made me think of not just in name. So even once you're in the door, you get sort of past the name piece. There are other things that we have to compromise about who we are to be able to fit into white spaces. Right. So and we've all been there. Right. The things around hair, the things about how we dress. Right. Like all of that really coming from, as you said, a trauma informed place. And so why do we, you know, because we don't get the same grace. To show up right in certain ways. And I laugh as I say that because I'm like, some of us have come back to work and we are just still doing COVID clothes. Like we're still,
we still. Let me tell you, I got a bunch of COVID shirts.
I'm like, yo, we're in public in that. I thought we were just wearing that on Zoom, right? So we have back to something that makes sense. So. I say that jokingly, but you know, the reality is like, I can't show up like that, right? We're back in person now. I can't be Dr. Markeisha and, right? Like also have these other elements about how I'm navigating a professional space and have people really take me seriously, right? To be very, very honest. So just putting that out there as well.
That's important. So here's the next thing that comes to mind for me. And this has been something I think I've thought about often, but I'm wondering, why is affirmative action so divisive at work? Let me tell you why I bring this up. I saw this same time, maybe last week, on smartbrief.com, right? So that they're talking about how to prepare people for the workforce of the future, and that leaders must be prepared for how we're going to work coming. And I love, there were some things that I thought were really important, right? That encouraging people to think about work as no longer one size fits all, which has been how we've operated for a long time. And the post-COVID, right? I mean, going through COVID and post-COVID workforce changes, we're seeing that it's now one size fits one. And there are lots of ways to accommodate people in the space. But in this discussion of what to think about in the future of work, they also said we want to acknowledge that one of the considerations is that 42% of employees think DEI work, so diversity, equity, inclusion, and Dr. Markeisha, you also work on belonging, is divisive. That this is a thing that separates us, that people get angry about, that people push back on. So why is it so divisive? And I guess the second part to that is, and how do we keep from drowning in the constant flow of conversation around this?
Yeah. That's a really good question. I was like, how am I gonna answer this? do I want to be careful or just, I mean, I think it comes down.
No careful required here.
Okay. All right.
Put on Markeisha. Come on, Markeisha.
I really think when you begin to, and this sort of goes to this conversation around anti-blackness to some degree, but when you begin to center black or brown folks, black folks, and the attention is taken off of white folks, they don't like that. That becomes a problem. People begin to feel attacked. There are feelings of guilt, right? I'm not a racist. Why are we, right? And not really thinking about the breadth and depth of what diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, as we do work on belonging where I am, what that really means, right? And so I think there's just this automatic, it's going to be about race. And somebody's going to have me in a workshop or have me in a conversation where I'm made to feel guilty, like I'm made to feel like I did something wrong. And then what ends up happening in those spaces is someone's feelings get hurt. There are tears that happen. And the real work that we need to be doing, we get away from that, right? We get totally distracted because now we're sort of trying to take care of someone's feelings because they feel like there's some personal attack. We are doing this as a personal attack. Other thing I hear often is, especially in the equity conversation, is that we are I've worked really hard. I've, pulled myself up by my bootstraps and I've worked really hard. And so now you're telling me that we're going to give opportunity to folks who have not, worked like I have not come from what I've come from. And so it's this, it becomes this resource battle, right? And so I don't want to give up or what I have, or I don't want anyone to take away my job, right? Because we're trying to fill some quota by having, a black person or black people be a part of a particular role, right, at work. And so I think that that's another piece that comes up. There's a lot just around, what about, right? So when we do have the conversations about race, very quickly turn into conversations about, well, I grew up poor and not really, again, I always tell folks, always is going to be, right? Like it still rises to the top. I don't care how you cut the data. So, that also becomes a part of the conversation. For me, all those are detours. That's all detours from us really doing the real work and acknowledging where we are. So I'll start there.
Leave it. That's a great place to start. Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's all fear-based. It's fear-based.
I thought there was more to that.
No, I was just commenting. I'm
sorry. Oh, no. I was ready. Like,
it's fear-based. When you think about self-preservation, me, myself, my family, my life, my income, my home, my community, these arguments have been made all along for a very long time. It isn't anything new, but it comes from the same seed of fear.
Totally agree. I'm just back here co-signing.
Yeah, because that's so interesting. So there's so many things that we do out of fear. And it's actually pretty fascinating how much of that shows up in workspaces. That so many of these responses about fear of losing something, that someone else is going to get something that I should have received, that you're going to get the promotion that was really meant for me, which may not be meant for you. That might not be in your path. You're going to get the raise that I should have got. Most of y'all work in organizations where there's plenty of money to go around. So we got to talk about how everyone gets compensated fairly, not just about this one row of people, right? This one category of folks. So I think the fear conversation is really significant too.
And so if it isn't fear, it's disbelief. Consider this. You can live in any neighborhood and drive any kind of car except for a top of the line something and show up at work. And suddenly you're looked at differently. Suddenly, how in the world did you get on your salary to be able to afford that? Why, you must certainly be doing something that is not legal, right? It shows up, that fear shows up in so many ways, that total disbelief. Or here's the other piece that shows up, why it's divisive, because gaslighting takes place. Gaslighting is real. You can share your experience, but they may not listen to you. They may not believe you. It's total disbelief. Like, nah, that didn't really happen. Or maybe that's just your take on it. No, really, this is what I experienced. So fear, disbelief, gaslighting, all of that together. Yeah, that's why DE&I is divisive. Not because it isn't right or put in perspective so that we can make sure that equity takes place in the workplace and in higher ed so that what? We can create these pipelines into the workspace. But this is what we're dealing with.
Well, and there's a privilege, right? There's white privilege. Like, you have the privilege to be able to say.
She said the P word.
Because I'm looking at my little knapsack, it don't have nothing in it, right? Like a piece of bread and a cracker, right? Like, so I just feel like maybe some lukewarm water, right? So there's privilege. Like, there's privilege in being able, like, to show up in a workspace and say what you're not going to do, right? Or what you're not going to support. Or, you know, that, so just that, right? And I've watched that happen day in, day out. Just things that you can say and ways in which you can be resistant to the movement, right? Or the direction that your organization is going. And nobody checks that, right? Or they'll just say, well, we need to bring them along, right? And I'm thinking, well, is that it? Or are they exercising this privilege, known or unknown, that they have to be able to say, like, I'm not going to sign on to that. And some of that, again, to Dr. Wendy's point, coming out of fear, right? All of these pieces, but there's still that privilege that is wrapped up in that response. And again, there's not a grace that is extended in the other direction. When I say I don't want to do something, it's a problem.
So not only am I going to say I don't want to do it, but I'm going to show up in my Beamer, right, which I already, that I'm not supposed to have. I'm saying, and no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, right. Good luck.
So this is a great conversation. So this notion of privilege and there's fear and all these things wrapped up in why the whole spectrum of things involved in the work we've got to do in the workplace to get us to clear ideas of diversity, true equity, inclusive practices, and cultures of belonging. I wonder how much of this is white noise, right? Is some of this chatter for the sake of chatter? Tell you why. I saw this in Fortune last week. It said that the diversity rhetoric is plummeting since this decision from the Supreme Court, that there is less mention of DEI plans on earnings calls, at conferences. They actually said it fell by 54%. It's at the lowest rate since 2018, where executives are talking about it specifically. This is part of what we're doing. And employment lawyers, and I saw some interviews with them, are even telling executives and CEOs, say less, don't make yourself a target if you don't have to. But here's the thing. So far, what they're reporting is, we see the rhetoric changing, but we don't have evidence that people are pulling back on the initiatives just yet. But they're aware.
Right.
Let's be careful so right. We don't do anything. So is this white noise? What's happening? I like when you start off that way.
I mentioned before in a comment this whole idea around taking detours, right? Like, it's easy to find ways to take away from what is the central mission or sort of vision around DEIB. It's very easy, right? And a lot of folks don't even recognize that they're taking those detours. And so I think that that's one piece of it. I think that there were a lot of organizations, obviously in the wake of George Floyd's murder, that really were like, we got to do DEI work. If they weren't doing it, all of a sudden there were all these roles and positions that were created. And if they were, like, we're doubling down. And I think post that, right, there is, and when you were saying those statistics, just thinking about even these roles, right, even roles for directors of diversity or chief equity officers, a lot of those are being eliminated from organizations as well. And that work is sort of maybe being, you know, captured in some other form or fashion. But I think it's interesting that, you know, the comments have come to me, right? Is this going to stop what we're doing? Now, the nature of those comments, I think you could probably guess where they're coming from, because you didn't want to do this, right, to begin with. And right now it's almost sort of some fuel, some fodder for you to be like, we don't have to do this because the Supreme Court said we didn't have to. And I'm like, ah, that's not, no. That's not what that said. I should do that tomorrow at work. I'm doing it.
That's going to be a meme after this.
Right. Monday morning. So I think, you know, that's, you're using this decision as a way to sort of say, we don't have to do this, right? And I don't know, white noise, right? It's very interesting because I think organizations are going through now this new transition point. We've done a lot of this work or sort of doubled down on this work. And now what? And has it really changed practice and policy? Or were we just doing some things that were performative? And if you've got the right folks in your organization, they're calling that out, I think, and saying, yeah, maybe this is performative and we need to sort of, you know, redirect. And I think in other ways, right, there's really an effort to keep this going. I know we've been, sure to let folks know, like, we're just not stopping what we're doing, like, we're still moving forward. But we get the questions. And I think we were getting those questions even before this. So this is just, like I said, something to latch on to try and make a case for why we shouldn't be doing the work. And I don't think people anticipated that might be have been an impact of the decision. Right. I think, you know, sort of it was like just school. Right. Or just like not seeing sort of the residual effect of some of that.
Yeah. Dr. Wendy, you have some thoughts on that?
I think Dr. Mariska.
You done gave me a new name, Dr. Wendy G.
And that's what they do.
Mariska.
That's what they do.
You summed it up.
That's what they do. So, all right. So let's try this. Excuse me. Because part of what you mentioned, Dr. Markeisha, is that you've been getting these messages and calls already, right? People are saying, what do we do? And people are, in some ways, organizations are leveraging this to say, we wanted to pull back on this a little bit anyway. And I read some stuff about what is called the chilling effect. And so basically it's just saying, when things like this happen, particularly with the Supreme Court decision, organizations can stop the movement behind this face of, and you mentioned it earlier, Dr. Wendy, fear, but also because we make sure we don't step in the wrong space now. Like, we don't want to get in trouble, so we can stop doing some things. I saw this, the Memphis Urban League did a paper. They put a statement out earlier in the summer saying that that there were unforeseen consequences of this striking down of affirmative action from the Supreme Court that employers would stop doing these types of things in fear of lawsuits. And then I just saw this last week in MarketWatch that, and this is, an incredible perspective by a great author, journalist, Levi Smagaisai. She says, the next frontier in the backlash around this is programs that help Black businesses and entrepreneurs, right? And to your point, Dr. Markeisha, that some of the spill out of this is beyond college admissions. It's beyond just the pipeline, but it's economical all the way around, right? So she's saying here that they already saw Supreme Courts in states like Tennessee make decisions saying that the Small Business Administration cannot presume social disadvantage now just because of race. So the money that was before earmarked to go to people of color in these types of communities because you are a Black-owned business or because you were LGBT-owned business, because you were those things, now we're saying, hold up. That's not, that those things aren't, don't equate necessarily now. So you got to do more to prove that there's disadvantage in your community for your business or to get contracts. So my question here is, how do we reduce this chilling effect?
Educate. Do not stop talking about it. This is the way of keeping you in your place. Always going to, there's going to be a law that's going to help to put that in place because we are a country governed by laws. And so if, as long as we can make the laws, we can change anything that we want to look like we want it to look like to affect the very people we don't ever want to see move ahead. And this is nothing new. This is an old playbook in a 21st century. Let's be real.
As you said that, Dr. Wendy, I thought, and who do we know the lawmakers are?
Hello.
Say that again for the people in the back of the room.
Right. Don't know if they look like anybody that's on this call today. That really, right, is when final decisions are being made, that there's you know, Black folks in a space, right? So there's that that comes up for me. I think what's interesting about California, and Lonnie may know this, having, you know, being a native Californian, is that we have something called Prop 209. And so if you are in a school, if you are a business that receives any federal funds, then you cannot have programs that are specifically earmarked for individuals of any particular racial category, right, or community. And this was like an eye-opener for me, coming from a place like Oregon and Portland, where we had, in procurement, for instance, we were able to have programs and really set aside funds to help build the minority women-owned, right, businesses that were contracting with the city at that time. And so we have programs that we were doing for Black business, right? Black contractors, subcontractors. And so you pivot, and I come to California and I was like, oh, so this looks different.
Surprise!
And so one of my first calls was with our procurement person. And he's like, yeah, we're really, you know, we're wanting to make sure that we are diversifying our contractors and the folks that are, you know, putting in bids to do work with us. And I'm going like into the things that were working in Portland. He was like, yeah, so. That won't really work here. Right. So that's why I said it's a very interesting conversation. And I said, so for California, I think the impacts are very different than they are in places, particularly in the South. Right. I heard a lot of what Lonnie were reading, like places in the South. Right. Other, like, because there's not the same. This has not been, there's not been anything earmarked since the 90s, right? Like, this has been something that has been trying, you know, they've been trying to overturn this for a very long time. And so this was never a factor in school decisions in California, right, to begin with. And so a lot of universities have gotten very creative around how they create programs for students of color. So I think that's just, it's sort of a, I'm in an interesting space with this now that I wasn't before, because it's like, we're talking about, you know, sort of preserving these resources and really thinking about how we help individuals who, you know, system hasn't valued ever. And so that, and I'm in a place where there's not ever been really, right, that sort of preservation. And we're trying to use maps and like other sort of ways in which to identify communities that have, you know, deficit in resources. And so it's a very interesting exercise that is often happening in my head to try and get creative around, like, how can we just do this to begin with? right? And other places are like, how can we just keep doing it, right? And I'm like, what's going on? Yeah. So anyway. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. So this is important because we're talking about the rules. While there are some federal guidelines, right, and there's some federal legislation, we know, and this has been something we look at, we hear all the time, that the rules in the states are different, right? And so you have to take it, and it can boil down to where you are and what county, what municipality, right? So all these things, it can, based on where you are, where, how your industry is infected, is affected, those things can be slightly different. So what you have to do is different. So this is to that point. And I'm wondering, are there particular industries that we need to worry about? Is the risk greater for some versus others? And here's why I say that. And this was just this week, and the Associated Press ran an article called Can Medicine Diversify Without Affirmative Action? And so they looked at this chart around the population versus the percent of doctors, right? So 59% of the population white, but they are 64% of physicians. 6% of the U.S. population is Asian, but they are 21% of physicians. Blacks are 19% of the population, but only 7% of physicians. Hispanics are 14%, but only 6% of physicians. And they looked at some schools, and particularly I think this is important, but Morehouse School of Medicine said, hey, we service this area, but we only have 115 openings every year, and we get 9,000 applications. So when we think about stuff like health disparities and how that shows up for us as doctors, and whether people listen to Black women about the issues they're having and presenting, or listen to Black men, or recognize symptoms that may not be what they generally see or what they experience in their own family, their own communities, I'm wondering if these issues about decisions relative to affirmative action and how it impacts the pipeline, if there are particular areas and industries across the workforce that we need to worry about.
I am really interested in the whole health disparities issue. With the numbers that you mentioned, Dr. Lonnie, the missing links. If you are in my community, but you don't necessarily understand the issues that we're faced with, how do you treat them? When I cross the line and I come for service and you blame me for being obese, you blame me for eating the wrong foods, when you blame me for making myself sick, but in my community, as what happened recently with Giant Food Store, the only full service grocery store in Southeast DC decides, well, we have had too much theft. And guess what we're going to do? We're removing the name brand items, and we're only going to serve you store brand items. So we're taking away your choices. We're going to minimize the number of doors you can go in and out. And how about we're going to have someone, we're going to pay somebody to stand at the door because we need to check your receipt on your way out. But you're not serving me and giving me what I need. So I don't go to the hospital where they may just see my face. And though I may be obese, right, you may think different about me and think that you're just not taking care of yourself and you want us to put you back together again like Humpty Dumpty, right? So I am concerned about that industry. And I know myself from having been a victim of that, walking in and a nurse said, oh, she's a drama mama. Temperature up the roof. I mean, I could have had COVID back then. It just wasn't a name. You know what I mean? It just wasn't known. Could have. The symptoms, when I think back to it, were very, very similar, but didn't see me as a sick individual. Saw me because I literally went to the ER with my pajamas on. You know, y'all know how our hair is, right? It takes the shape of the pillow. When we get up, it's smushed, looking just like the pillow. You all know that.
I never heard that.
Yes, well, it does. And it's what I look like. That's what I look like. I didn't have on my bonnet. I didn't wear my bonnet. I was sick. And I just rolled in there. And they just thought I was a poor member of the community who just had not taken care of it. And because of that one comment, it took them too long to take me seriously, to triage me, to care for me. And I had temperature. I could have infected everybody else around there had it been something, right? Like COVID.
Yeah.
So these are the things that we can't ignore when DE&I shows up or not.
Just to add on to that, and then so I'm concerned about education, but to add on, thinking K-12 in particular, but to add on to that, I was thinking about just the assumptions that are made when Black folks show up right at the doctor or the hospital, and there are particular things about their physical appearance, and there's automatically some assumptions that are made, not recognizing that if you have generational trauma, if you are stressed, if there are these other environmental factors that are happening around
that's
you,
that's right.
Then we disproportionately have high
that's blood right.
pressure, have diabetes, right? There's no
that's right.
No like that shouldn't like we're not surprised, right? There is a correlation, direct correlation between our health outcomes and the other sort of internal traumas that we carry, and that shows up right in healthcare. And then we have food deserts, like there's just places where they're not healthy options. And for a lot of the reasons that Dr. Wendy noted, Walmart right now, I haven't been in a Walmart yet in California where I don't have to, like, they put things now in a box, like a lock box. And you have to take that to the checkout. Right?
You couldn't even, the one I was just, and Dr. Wendy knows this, I'm taking care of my aunt up near in the suburb of Philadelphia, and the soap will be behind, the bars of soap behind locked glass.
Right.
You got to push a button, wait for somebody to come and open, open the display.
Working, right?
Yeah.
Two people working in the whole Walmart, and you can't get laundry detergent. Laundry detergent is locked up. I thought, like, I was like, why is there Vaseline behind the thing? Like, what are you doing with Vaseline? Like,
how about alcohol? How about alcohol? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I asked, the clerk, is there a problem? With, I mean, 70% isopropyl? I just didn't understand it.
I mean, it costs 93 cents. Can I just get it,
please? Let me tell you. Look, they locking up lashes. And so, you know, you can't get your lashes, sis. I am. All the things. Alcohol, lashes, Vaseline. These are like the staples, right? I'm really concerned about education. And I think, you know, having been an educator in the K-12 education system, having children now, I have a son that's in third grade and my daughter is in eighth grade, continue just to have concerns about how these sorts of decisions impact them at that level. We talk a lot about, of course, higher education, right? But what's happening in K-12? And just as an example, not very, very long ago, because my daughter's just 13, I remember just the simple fact that she had beads in her hair, became a problem. The teacher was like, she's making too much noise when she, yes or no. And I was just like, so vigorous or like, what's the, right? Like that's a distraction, right? And so, but we're taking a moment out to, you know, center a child about something in their physical appearance.
Wow.
And that's the, you know, we've automatically made some judgment, right? Or some assumption about what they're capable of. Obviously as a mother of a young Black boy, I worry. It was
absolutely.
So, for me, so imperative that he was reading before he went, like, out. You reading in kindergarten, because I know what the research says about kids, right? Falling behind and what happens, and you know, where they end up. And so we've had these issues. This is not just a matter of decisions that we're talking about right in the present. But I think the more of that sort of thing that happens, there is a trickle down effect on what happens to students in schools. And frankly, I mean, we do not have like just, you know, you poll a lot of people who wants to be a teacher, right? Like not a lot of hands going up, right? So there's also not representation in our classrooms. And that has historical, you know, just with desegregation, right? There's some historical facts to that. But I think just that is also another concern for me.
Especially with Black males in the classroom mm-hmm. as teachers, there's a missing Black male as teachers.
Mm-hmm. There's one at my son's school, and I was like, "Oh my goodness, hello, sir!" I know you thought I was just excited, right, to see, because that is very, very rare, especially the elementary school. You'll see a little bit more in middle and high school, but it is very rare, Dr. Wendy. So,
wow. Thank you both for sharing those examples. I mean, my concerns are across both of those industries, I mean, medicine as well. I just think all these different things. And when you were talking, Dr. Markeisha, I thought it's just something as simple as we started with higher ed and the decision around college admissions. I'm thinking, so what if a Black or brown person calls to ask a question about their application, right? So even the inflections in the voice, or the tone that you pick up. And when I tell you that my name is X, Y, and Z, so while we can erase it from the application, you can't erase it. You just can't erase it, right? So here's my last question. And this is a little more complex, I think, or maybe not. But there are multiple things that feed into this. How do we hold organizations accountable for this? So there are two things I want to raise in this. One, we just saw this yesterday, and I'm glad this came out, and it resonates with me for so many reasons. But if either you saw the former NFL Network reporter Jim Trotter, who filed a lawsuit against the NFL Network. And saying, hey, I am suing because the cable channel and the league discriminated against me, is discriminatory, and they're retaliating against me for raising issues around DEI. And there's nothing in belongingness in this conversation here. But part of what you're reading about this is a Black man who's saying, look, I raised issues about it because the league said and the network said they were committed to this. So I was asking questions about why aren't we making the targets that you said you wanted to hit? I didn't see it reflected in the executive staff. We don't have Black copywriters, like all these things that are missing, but you're saying you want to see this. And he said, I can't complain about things that are wrong if I'm not willing to fight for what is right. And in his case, what part of the claim that he's making is that while the NFL and the network claims to want to be accountable, it costs me my job. So we've seen this, right? And Dr. Winnie, you mentioned that. Some of these things coming back around all the time. So I'm asking, how do we hold them accountable? Because this is a reality for people that we see organizations talking about it, and I'm sure you see this, Dr. Markeisha, in your organization and other organizations where you've been leading these charges. And then what happens is you push back because, well, you said you wanted to do it. So I'm walking with you. I'm sitting on the committees talking about it. I'm going out to the places you told me to go and sit and talk to people about the pipeline. But I'm also asking questions because I'm looking at the numbers. And what we know, and Dr. Winnie and I talk about this all the time, is sometimes the numbers don't tell the whole story. So I see the numbers that you're reporting out at these big meetings, but I also know the experiences that people are having here. So while we're getting to diversity, we aren't necessarily practicing inclusion. And we damn sure aren't hitting on belongingness. So help me, help us. How do we hold organizations accountable for this?
One of the first things that came to mind for me was around the performance evaluation I think that when you start messing,
oh, you know how much we hate those on this show.
That's the other P word. Dirty word, dirty word.
All the P bombs, all the P bombs.
I am still stop Porsche performance evaluation. I'm telling you, when you start messing with people with number, like people's numbers, right, and money, because a lot of times in organizations, performance evaluation, like your performance is tied to some sort of incentive.
Yeah.
Right. It catches people. And like, so I've been having this conversation recently. That's why it's sort of top of mind. But what are what do DEIB behaviors look like? And how do we hold, particularly, and this is my other point, top leadership. So if you don't have, you know, your CEO, the person that is at the very top, and whatever your executive cabinet, whatever that looks like, if they are not completely wholeheartedly committed to the work of diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, if they are not demonstrating that in the way in which they interact and lead the organization, then that's problematic, right? But how are we embedding this into this accountability around your performance? And if you are not exhibiting that behavior, it's not just a slap on the hand. Hey, we may even let you keep your job. But let's come in and have a conversation. Let's coach you. Let's talk about, you know, what this looks like. And if you're still not able to sort of make those shifts, then maybe we need to talk about what the next stage on your journey looks like. But I think those are the conversations we don't want to have. And they're tough because there are a lot of places that are very union heavy. And so when you have unions in place and folks that are protected by unions, that gets hard because you can't just say, like, you're out of here. Right. There has to be sort of a buildup to that. I, you know, have experienced that. So I think those are just some of the, you know, two of the things right around those evaluations and your leadership that are top of mind for me. And I've been left holding the bag a lot of times. Like, I thought you had my back. Where you at? You said you wanted to do a thing, right?
Yeah.
And here we are. And I'm just sort of left out there. Right. And having to fight for my well-being, right? And my money, my coins, because here I am now having to make maybe a pivot that I didn't anticipate. So just putting that out there as well.
I love that. Dr. Wendy, what are your thoughts?
I think you know, when you look at the websites, and the websites have these wonderful diversity pages that say all of the right things. And when you get in the organization,
you can see me rolling my eyes. Like,
yes. And you get in the organization and you don't see that. Where do you go? You're on the outside looking in. Consumers have a really good chance to break the bank, but we don't take those opportunities. NFL wouldn't get a dime of my money. I don't buy a t-shirt that says the NFL anything, not a cup, nothing. I mean, we really have to begin to think about how we are going to support these organizations that just don't support us all the time. If we decided, and it's not going to happen because so many people believe in, you know, oh, I'm going to, you know, my team. But guess what? Guess what Gruden said about you? And he said, but I'm not a racist. Right? This happened over and over and over again. He said, but that's not who I am for real, though. Trotter had to lose his right. Trotter is the sacrificial lamb for telling the truth. He is the courageous one who stood up to this toxic behavior. But if everyone else would follow behind that and say, we're not going to do this anymore, we're not going to have it, because it still isn't enough to make a change, because they didn't say right away, let's fix this, let's come to the table and make this right. Did they say that? Or is there another part of the article I missed? I'm just saying.
I want to round this part of the conversation out with something I saw in the Management and Economics Journal earlier this year. And it's a study on measuring. So the measurement, impact, and strategy for affirmative action and, guess what, social justice, right? Because this is all about social justice. It's about justice for people in spaces. And there are two things in the findings that I thought were not peculiar, but discussion worthy. Nearly half of the people interviewed knew that affirmative action was measured, but had no idea how, right? Well, we know they're talking about it, but we have no clue what the results need to look like. Nearly 60% of the people they surveyed believe that affirmative action was addressing some historic racial imbalances in the workplace. However, 70% of people they surveyed felt that it was negatively viewed in their organization. See, half of them said, we know they're talking about it, but we don't know what the targets are and how to understand it, if we're achieving it. But 70% of them said, we know people hate it. And this is the other one that's really critical. And 82% of the people they surveyed said, while we know they're talking about it, we know it's difficult for people. I'm not sure how it's measured, but I'm going to tell you one thing. My compensation still ain't right. The organization is looking at it. I'm not sure how they measuring it or how they getting to the goals, but I know I'm still not being paid what I'm worth. I'm not being paid what my counterparts are being paid who are from other races. So my question to you, Dr. Wendy, Dr. Markeisha, is how do we make it right?
First word that popped in my head is transparency. It's in all what you shared, right? All those statistics let me know that there's a lack of transparency. People don't really know how this functions. And I think that's by design, for sure. And like you said, I know something wrong with my paycheck, but I just can't seem to. I emailed in the day about mine. Like, I got more. Like, I don't want to owe y'all. So let me-
Is this right?
They're like, it's fine, Keisha. You're okay, because y'all be coming at the end of the year. So I think that's, you know, it's the transparency and really the education around what this looks like, what this means for our organization. We're putting together kind of an FAQ because we have had a lot of questions and are trying to be as transparent about the immediate effects, right? The immediate impacts on what we do every day. And to certainly dispel the notion that, you know, we're not going to stop doing the work of DEIB. But I think that that for me feels like a good place to start and to have the right folks creating that message, because, you know, who the message is creates the message, and, you know, the audience in which they create the message for really makes a difference. So I'll leave it there.
Mm. Dr. Wendy.
I am not in that space where I have the same experiences for that. So I really am going to let Dr. Markeisha's comments run, because you really hit the nail on the head, is that you keep looking for this change. You keep looking. You don't see it. Although we don't know how it's measured, right? We don't know. And it could be different in different industries. It could be different in different places, different regions. We really don't know how that's done. And so how do we hold them accountable for making these changes, right?
So I appreciate that. I think part of what rises to the top for me right now is perhaps we need to have some national measures of this, right? Maybe there should be something that is universal that people understand, so that it's not so foreign, so that you can't be in an organization and don't understand that even though your CEO is talking about diversity, but you're not clear what that means to your space. So perhaps part of this is not just at the organization level, at the department level, but it's raising it to a national level where we are clear about the language in this, right? So we get to DEI and B because we're saying we need universal language to talk about it. But what this data show us is that we're still unclear about how people get out of that, right? We know there's a lens through which we see stuff, but we don't know what the results should look like. So perhaps generating something that helps everyone have clarity around it would be substantial for us. I think there's so much more we could talk about in this, but I think we're at a point where I want to recap the important pieces that we have identified today, because some of this is so brilliant that I'm still shaking in my seat. Like, man, this is beyond what I was thinking, but also important for the conversation, not just for us in this moment, but as we're going forward and doing this work, because not everyone is a soldier in the DEIB space like Dr. Markeisha. Some of us are doing this work, and I think it's important for us to do the work from where we sit, right? So for employees, what we recognize today, what we identify today, is that we want you to be really clear about how you preserve the things that you are proud of and make sure that those things that we're balancing is not keeping you from having access to opportunities. Something as simple as your name. There is nobody here to Access Point is saying to use abbreviations or to use just initials, right? We're saying stand in all of your greatness. For employees, we want you to think about the detours that you might be taking, whether they are intentional or unintentional. The excuses that you're making around diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging that are keeping other people, your colleagues, not just in your organization, but in your profession, from feeling like they're a part of the global community in that. Education is your responsibility. We've got to keep talking about these issues. We got to keep pushing the envelope. We got to keep voting. We got to keep pressing forward. All the things that are along the pipeline of this are important for us where we sit as employees. I think this is really critical. Recognize the source of your information. We question, well, who is making the laws, right? Sometimes the people who are making the laws are the ones who are conveniently forgetting how those practices have helped them move forward or remove barriers for them. Who is making the rules? What is the vantage point of the people who are setting the stage for how we move in this? I think the conversation about Dr. Markeisha, just the difference between Oregon and California. And so knowing your state laws and that there are rules and differences in different places. And I think what you can learn from the examples in other regions, other industries, and other people's practices can very much inform how you change the landscape in your own space. This is something Dr. Wendy said is, how are we aligning the values with your behavior? Who do you support with your dollars and your time? If you are aware that this organization, this industry is not standing up for what you believe in, why? Or why are you spending money with them? Or are you still spending money with them? For our leaders and managers and supervisors, we want you to think about, how are you safeguarding the space for people in the pipeline to show up the way they want to show up? Are you creating a space where they are comfortable, where they feel included, where they feel like they belong? Are you ensuring that this is not a battle of resources? Dr. Markeisha said, when we make this about resources, that's just a detour. It's getting us off of the main line of what we're pushing for here. Recognize that self-preservation will stand up in front of all of us, and it is fear-based, that people are responding with hesitations that get us away from the big picture here. Look for examples of disbelief. Because those are when people say, well, I don't believe that that's your experience, or that didn't happen for me, or I didn't know it was like that. Those are also ways that people derail the progress. I love this one. Recognize privilege and check it. Because this is another way that we derail the organization, because you have access to resources and things that everyone doesn't have access and resources to, doesn't mean that your experience trumps someone else's. How do we keep the movement going? It's something that we all must consider, particularly when you are leading people and managing people and supervising units, because we have to get rid of all the derailment attempts. what connections are you making across industries? We talked about what it means from groceries to doctors and food deserts. Think about farmers and all the people involved in getting healthy food into a space and what that looks like, what that shows up when you remove the lens of affirmative action in that thinking and remove the lens of diverse thinking and inclusive thought, and inclusive practices around that. What behaviors do you model as a leader and as a manager that people recognize this is part of what you value and what you want them to value and how you want them to behave and how you want to show up in the space? I love this one. Who do you leave holding the bag? That's so significant. There's a lot of talk out there, and we hear on this. There's some white noise about this work. And you should not be the person leaving someone else there trying to figure out what just happened. I know this happened to me. Dr. Markeisha said it's happened to her. I know it's happened to Dr. Wendy. From groups and teams, consider the breadth and depth of the work that is happening along the spectrum of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. This is not about guilt. So we don't want you to feel guilty because of who you are. We want to expand your perspective on it so that you understand other people's experiences as well. This is not about guilting you. It's about bringing us all up to speed, making us all have equity in our space. Diversity work is not about personal attacks. It's not about you. It's about all of us. We are not making you the bad guy. From an organizational or a bad woman, from an organizational perspective, consider the pipeline. What does it mean to diversify your workforce in thought, in person, in practice, in resources, in suppliers? All the things we think about. These are large macro level things that we want you to consider. This is one that's near and dear to my heart. How are you excluding people? Because we start working on diversity stuff and inclusion stuff, and we start thinking about how can we do these, but we don't always take the time to recognize here's how we are putting up barriers. What compromises are you forcing people of color to endure? I love that one. Those are the hard questions we have to ask. Those are those look in the mirror and figure this out. And I don't know if I want to look at myself, right? How are you forcing people to compromise in ways that are uncomfortable and they shouldn't have to? Are you using things like the Supreme Court's decision about affirmative action in college admissions to justify things you didn't want to do in the first place? Those are real questions. Those are personal questions. Those are about what you value, how you see other people, how you engage. Was it all performative? That's about the organization identity. Connect what you're doing on the spectrum of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging to performance and to financial incentives. We know this. We talk about this all the time. What people measure gets attention. And so if you lock it in to how you are evaluating and rewarding people, it becomes real. And the last thing we just talked about is it has to be transparent. What are you talking about? What are you saying to people? What's the language that you're using? How are you communicating the breadth of the work to your entire workplace community? This is important for all of us. So if people who are listening to this show decide that they do not want to heed the advice that we've pulled together and curating this conversation today, what is the tax that they pay? What is the black and brown tax they pay for not heeding this advice? Dr. Markeisha.
Ooh, child. First, so very impressed by that recap. Just want to put that out there. So shout out.
Say it again. Yes, the brother has it down. Yes.
I was like, all that, right?
He does that. Yes.
I'm real so time. Impressed. Like, yes. So I'm giving That's you it. Flowers.
Thank you so much.
That was amazing. I say, like, we, like, the tax is to me, kind of twofold. Like, we're going to continue to have to be at the center of this. Like, there's fatigue around this, right? When you're in a space, and the impact that that has on your physical, on your mental, right, on your emotional well-being, just having to carry this. And I think, you know, what ends up happening is there's burnout, right? Like, there's people get tired and they leave, right? And things that they've been very passionate about, they find themselves having to you know, take some other path, because all of this is happening. Not only, you know, they're watching it happen to them, but to colleagues, right? And if you're in a leadership position, that's even more more telling. And so I think this, you know, it's a lot to carry. That's what was coming up for me as you were saying that. If we don't have folks that are heeding the conversation that we've had today, we're going to have very toxic workplaces, right? We're perpetuating toxicity in our workplaces. And that hits different for Black and brown folks, right? There's some reality in that from a health perspective. So that's what I've got.
I also think that just having the courage to stand up, to ask the questions, we see the price that we pay. But if we don't do that, we'll be relegated to the corner, to the timeout chair. We then become invisible. So though we experience the fatigue, if changing and making a shift is important for your health, don't stop. We must be seen. We must be heard. We must make the difference.
Mm, I love that. And what it brings to mind for me is what happens over generations in the workplace. And we talk a lot about differences in generations here on the Access Point. And we've been doing a lot of work around what's happening with Gen Z and versus Gen X. But I think if we don't take these things seriously, if we don't recognize the impact of that decision on the workforce pipeline and the connections across industry, and we talk about the grocery store and the food desert and what it means and getting the basic staples of things you need locked behind counters and getting your receipt checked. We don't recognize that all of those things are connected. I have no idea what that will mean for my nieces, my nephews, when they enter the workforce, for your children, when they enter the workforce. So as always, the work we do is not just about us. While about us is really important, it's also about setting the stage for the people that we love who come behind us to live a productive whole life. And if we don't change the face of work right now, we are doomed. That's gloomy.
I'm like,
it's real.
That's gloomy.
It's real.
But it's real.
Absolutely.
It's gloomy, but it's real.
It's real.
So I want to say thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for everyone who's listening to the Access Point. We're so excited to be back for season 5. Dr. Markeisha, thank you so much for your expertise and your perspective and sharing such brilliance with us. It's so, so, so nice to have you here. We're so excited. And for everybody who's listening, you can listen to the Access Point wherever you get your podcast. Remember to like, share, comment, subscribe. If there was something that we shared that resonated with you, if you have a lingering question, there's an aha moment, there should be a lot of those, or some thoughts for a future discussion, use the hashtag TAP Reflection. So that's TAP as in the Access Point Reflections across all the various social media channels. Let us know. It is always a great time with you, Dr. Wendy, Dr. Markeisha. We will see you another time. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night. Good night, good night. Dr. Markeisha. Good night.
Thank you.
Living Corporate is a podcast by Living Corporate LLC. Our logo was designed by David Dawkins. Our theme music was produced by Ken Brown. Additional music production by Antoine Franklin for Musical Elevation. Post-production is handled by Jeremy Jackson. Got a topic suggestion? Email us at livingcorporatepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us online on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and living-corporate.com. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.